I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, a story about sex. Really. The 60th anniversary of the release of the first Kinsey Report reminds us how difficult it was in years past to talk about sex, and I don't mean just on the radio, I mean in any kind of mixed company. Alfred Kinsey was a biologist who led a course on sex for married students at Indiana University and quickly discovered how little was being said and how little was known. That set him on his famous quest to interview thousands of men and women, asking them questions about things like oral sex and orgasms to better understand sex as something more than the biological act of making babies. It took Kinsey and it took science and everyone else into the uncharted territory of openly discussing pleasure and sex and homosexuality and extramarital and premarital sex, issues rarely discussed in the living rooms of America. I'll talk with one woman, one of Kinsey's interviewees, right after the news. If you look at the Kinsey reports today, they seem like little more than columns of numbers and percentages. Sexual behavior in the human male, 1948. Sexual behavior in the human female. These books told no narratives, gave no names, contained no pictures. And yet, for the first time, they told a story about how real people enjoyed sex. And with whom, and how often, and when, and why. The identities of the thousands who were interviewed for the Kinsey reports were carefully guarded, but Alice Jeanette Cohen was then all of 19 and happy to take part.
I considered Kinsey a pioneer. I thought all this information was needed, and he was the first one who had the courage to start it. Somebody had to open that door, and he did.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Alice Jeanette Cohen was born in Czechoslovakia. She moved to the U.S. when she was 14. She remembers what her mother told her about sex. Nothing.
My mother didn't inform me about anything. In fact, my mother was so naive, I'm not so sure she knew where her four children came from.
It doesn't sound like you're joking.
No, I'm not. I'm not. My mother was very naive about sex, purposely. She didn't want to know. And she never, never discussed any of it with any of us.
Did you learn about sex then in college? Did you pick it up day by day in various conversations? How did you finally figure out what was going on?
Year by year, right. Well, you don't really need to know that much.
You know, as a boy, we wanted to know everything. We wanted to know everything right away. We wanted to know all the details.
Well, I'll tell you what I did do very young. At the age of 10, I read Anna Karenina, and I think that's where I got part of my sex education. In other words, it had to do with relationships and how sex enters into it, because Anna Karenina left her husband to be with her lover, 19th century Russia. You can imagine how ostracized she was, but she left, obviously, because she fell in love with him, which meant she enjoyed having sex with him. Even as a 10-year-old, I could figure that out.
I mean, it's a good point that you make, Alice, that sex education is not just biology. It's about emotion. It's about passion. It's about understanding love. And what you're telling me is that you were able to learn a fair amount of that by reading books, right?
Absolutely. I read a lot of grown-up books. I would take my brother's library card and go to the adult library and take out books.
Somehow, Alice ended up in this landmark American survey about human sexual behavior. It came through one of the men who helped Alfred Kinsey with his early research.
I was a refugee. I was extremely poor, and I wanted to finish in 3 years. So in the summer, I went to Brooklyn College, and there I met Professor Maslow. I took his course, in fact, and he told me about Kinsey because Kinsey had come to Brooklyn College to do interviews, and Maslow helped him. So Maslow told me all about him and the research he was doing. And I sort of, also I sort of got involved in sort of sexual discussions because Professor Maslow was doing research. He graduated with University of Wisconsin. And when he left some students doing, continuing his research on sex.
What kind of research was going on?
I don't remember exactly what his topic was, but I know it had to do with sex. How do I know? Because he used to get letters from Wisconsin in German because you couldn't send lewd article through the mail. So they wrote it in German. He couldn't read German, but I could. So he asked me to read it. And so I learned a great deal about sort of kinky sex before I knew anything about real sex.
You're translating letters written in German about kinky sex to a professor who has to have them written in a foreign language so they're legal to be sent through the U.S. Post?
Absolutely. Yes. And I was at that time, what, 19?
Well, what sort of things were written in these letters?
I think they must have done interviews with subjects in Wisconsin, and they sent him the material.
So
I heard about Kinsey Berry already that summer before I went back to Indiana.
And when did you finally meet him?
In 1944, 43, I'm not quite sure. I was either 19 or 20. I was majoring in psychology, and he came to very wisely. He needed subjects very badly. And in those days, people weren't going to offer to talk about their sex life. So he came to the psych department and gave a lecture. Now, the lecture is very memorable to me. I remember it so clearly, and it's 60 years. He came, you know, a lot of us decided to go to the lecture because we had heard about, I had certainly heard about Kinsey. And he came in with his wife. And he stood up and he introduced himself. His wife sat down and she took out her knitting.
Was she up on the stage with him or sitting down with you with the rest of the students?
No. She sat next to him.
Up on the stage.
Right. And she took out her knitting. And, you know, I read The Tale of Two Cities. So to me, Madame Lafarge, I was wondering whose head was going to fall next. It was very odd to me that she would sit there and knit. I wasn't sure if it was some shorthand that she was doing, but there she was.
Well, wait a second. Explain to me, what was it that Professor Kinsey was talking about?
Oh, Professor Kinsey realized that in order to get us interested, he had to give us something that we had never heard of. He said that he had just come back from Chicago. And he interviewed some very wealthy people, and he said they also practice incest.
Incest?
That was a big, big shocker. Because you always somehow thought from all the literature you read that it was the lower classes that practiced incest. And here he comes and tells you the rich people also practice incest.
Do you think he was trying to shock you in some way?
Yes, he was. Oh, I'm sure he was.
The thing, the picture that stuck in my mind, though, is Professor Kinsey at the podium talking about incest and sex and stuff like that, and his wife sitting beside him doing her knitting.
Absolutely. How do you think I felt?
But it's like a cartoon. It's almost as if he brought his wife to give him some legitimacy or to give so he wouldn't be seen to be misbehaving himself.
You are absolutely right. He brought her because they were so afraid that he was afraid that if he came alone, some of the girls there might get very upset and call their parents and talk about how this man came and told us these horrible things. With his wife there, he was a married man, he had a wife, it was okay.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. And so it was 64 years ago when Alice Jeanette Cohn, then a young college girl, sat face to face with the man who went on to become one of the leading researchers on sexuality in the U.S. Now, the kinds of questions she heard were replayed in a recent movie called Kinsey, and they were not the sort of questions that most Americans were accustomed to answering.
How did you first find out about masturbation?
I invented it, son.
How often do you have intercourse?
Two or three times.
A month?
No, a day.
How often do you reach orgasm?
Once.
A day?
No, only once. About 20 years ago, I was sitting on a piano stool listening to music.
Oh, that's good.
Alice readily answered everything she was asked. In fact, she admits she was quite drawn to Kinsey.
I found him so attractive. I thought he was very handsome, very attractive. And he was very kind. He was really concerned. He wanted people to enjoy sex in their marriage. He never, never talked about having it outside the marriage.
It sounds in a way like you had something of a crush on him.
I did. I admit I did.
So,
I did. You spend time with him and you just can't, at least I couldn't help myself. Remember, I was 19.
Yeah, so describe him physically. I just have, you know, a sort of mental picture of a professorial-looking face. What was it that was attractive about him?
He was a professor. You're absolutely right about that. I found him to be tall, maybe because I'm not so tall. I found him tall and very pleasant-looking. He was not, you know, Clark Gable. He was not gorgeous, but he was extremely pleasant-looking and kind-looking and interested. He genuinely wanted to understand you. I found him a very attractive human being.
And so when Kinsey was doing these famous interviews with people, asking them mm-hmm. about their sexual lives, did he ask for volunteers or did he say to you, Alice, I'd like you to be one of the people I speak to? How did that work?
Oh, no, definitely volunteers. No, that's why he came to the psych department, because he figured since we volunteered for all kinds of experiments, we were more likely to volunteer. And we did. Most of my friends were interviewed.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't sound like you hesitated at all.
No, I liked being with him. I wanted to be with him.
So you and a bunch of your friends, what, 19, 20 years old, psych
right.
students in the mid-40s then, sat down with Professor Kinsey and... What happened there? What did he have a list of questions or what happened?
Of course he did. There was a big table. He sat at one end and you sat at the other end of the table and you looked at each other. I remember he offered cigarettes. In those days, people offered you cigarettes. I never smoked, so right. I declined. I took water. Now, for the first hour, the questions had to do with pre-intercourse sex.
He was talking about growing up, masturbation, things like that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And if after the end of the first hour, he asked you if you had intercourse, and if you said yes, you stayed another hour. And what I discovered is that some boys would come and sit outside and wait. And if a girl stayed 2 hours, that's the girls they became interested in because they weren't virgins. And nobody figured that out except me, because when I told it to one of the assistants many years later, he was shocked.
This is probably the time when I should ask you how long your interview went with Dr. Kinsey.
Oh, you may ask, but I will probably not answer.
And she doesn't tell. Alice Chanot Cohen is now 83. She says she's been asked many times what it was she told Dr. Kinsey for her part in adding to the Kinsey Report research. And just as all the original data remains anonymous to this day, so Alice's stories remain something for the sex researcher alone. In just a moment, I'll talk with Alice about how the Kinsey Reports changed her world and everyone else's. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. 60 years ago today, a landmark study was published, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male. It became known simply as one of the Kinsey Reports, followed a few years later by the companion, Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. Well, in the years just after the Second World War, the reports talked openly about matters like masturbation. Back then, many people said it was too much, way too much.
I don't think that any decent woman would... give a man her opinions on such a matter. I know my sister wouldn't. I'm quite sure my mother wouldn't.
But Alice Chanot Cohen did. And she'd argue that she's every bit a decent woman, though perhaps one who at 19 was more willing to be a part of such a controversial piece of research. Now, we've often heard about the details in the study, but less about what happened in the gathering of the material. I asked Alice to tell me what happened when she was in the room.
He just wrote whatever he was really interested in for his... Remember, the book is a statistical book.
Yeah, we kind of forget that. We think of it as a sort of, collection of little anecdotes, but it's not,
no.
Is it?
If you read the book, you find that I'm just one statistic. That's all I am in there. Now, he would have little vignettes that he probably, after you left, he wrote them out that interested him, that he wanted to use.
Were you surprised at the detail that he wanted from you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, very surprised. It was incredible detail. Incredible.
I mean, when we talk about the detail, and I'm not trying to pry here, but was he saying to you, on what day did you have this thought? Or
no. How old do you think you were?
And was a lot of it asking you to remember back to your very first sexual thoughts, that sort of thing?
Oh, I think in my first year.
Seriously?
Yes. Yes. My earliest memory.
Did he ever make any comment as he gathered the information from someone?
Never. You know, he just gave you sort of an encouraging smile. And you had the feeling that he wasn't sitting in judgment of you.
What's your memory of the session itself, Alice? Was the experience itself somewhat sensual, or was it very clinical?
Very clinical. Unfortunately, not at all sexual.
And when it was over, did you and your friends go for coffee and compare notes? Well, what did he ask you, and what did he ask you?
Nobody shared. Your sex life is private.
Well, it may have been private in 1944, but I get the impression it's not so private these days, not to listen to the
You're
way people tell their stories.
No, absolutely not as private. Well, the movies, everything. No, nothing is. But in 44, it most certainly was.
This is a part that you can help me with, Alice, that I've never really, I don't think, clearly understood. And that is why the work that Kinsey was doing in the mid-40s and then with the publication of the reports after that, why it was so controversial.
You know, in that respect, I don't think we have changed much. We don't mind speaking about violence. But we still get upset when we speak about sex. Or as I say it, when sex rears its ugly head. Sex is a no-no, unless you have sex within a marriage to procreate. But sex for pleasure is considered sinful.
And that's what he started talking about. He started talking about men and women having pleasure, having sex. And that was what initially enraged people, wasn't it?
Oh, well, also the statistics are what he came up with. For instance, that women also had extramarital sex, not only men. I mean, that was mind-boggling in those days. Or that the percentage of girls who had sex before they were married, mind-boggling.
Well, a lot of people said it was pure bunkum. They just didn't believe it, right?
Absolutely. Well, what they said, this was a select population, which is true. It was volunteers. So it's certainly a select population, statistically.
It wasn't a statistical cross-section of America by any means.
Absolutely. But all that information just, oh, my God, they vilified him afterwards. And Rockefeller, who supported him, withdrew the support after the book was on female sexuality.
Yeah.
Male, somehow nobody got too upset. But female, that's when Rockefeller withdrew.
I mean, some of the stuff that they said, Alice, is quite remarkable. I have notes that were taken back at the time, and it talks about, I think it's Rockefeller, calling the women who took part in the study frustrated, neurotic outcasts of society. Do you remember
this? That's me. That's me. Yes.
The insult of the century against our mothers, wives, daughters, and sisters. That's you too?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's me too.
So what did it do? Did it make two camps? Were there those who thought that the Kinsey reports were valuable, useful, interesting information, and others who thought it was some kind of abomination? Did it create a divide when the Kinsey reports were published?
I think this country always has a divide. I considered Kinsey a pioneer. I thought all this information was needed, and he was the first one who had the courage to start it. Somebody had to open that door, and he did. He paid a terrible price for it.
The criticism Dr. Kinsey took was well documented in the media at the time, and since then, in books and in films.
Dr. Kinsey's one-sided report is an indictment against American womanhood. It will cause children to doubt the fidelity of their parents and will lead to various types of moral abuses.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Alice Jeanette Cohen was one of the women who contributed her own sexual history to the compilation of data in the Kinsey reports. I asked her if she told other people at the time that she was a part of this, especially her parents.
I don't think they would have known what I was talking about.
If you'd sat down at the dinner table and said, I had a long conversation about my earliest sexual fantasies with a professor at college today, you probably would have got your mother's attention.
Yes, but she probably would have said, I didn't know you had sexual fantasies. Or that anybody has sexual fantasies. What's that?
Do you remember, Alice, the first time that you started to talk about participating in the Kinsey reports? Was it anything that, was there any reason that brought it up, like the publication of the report? You went, oh, yeah, I was one of those people.
I think when the book came out, I probably did tell my friends that I was, that I'm one of the statistics there. Yes, I think I did. But I really outed myself. You know, what's happened is that they made so sure that nobody, you could never trace anyone who was a subject, that you can't trace anyone who was a subject. But when I was revising my late husband's book, Between Parent and Child, I needed some information about homosexuality, and I called the Kinsey Institute, and I chatted with them, and I said, by the way, I was interviewed by Kinsey. So I outed myself. And, of course, then in 2003, when there was the 50-year celebration, people would call and say, we'd like to interview someone who was interviewed by Kinsey. Oh, there is Alice Jeanette Cohen. They couldn't find.
You became the poster child for the Kinsey Report.
Absolutely.
Alice, do you remember getting your copy of the Kinsey Report?
You mean in 53?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. Oh, yes. I bought it. I was excited to see it. I was disappointed. It was mostly statistics. I also was looking for some tidbits.
And nothing that you, no part of it that you went, hey, that's me.
The only thing I could say is, oh, so 40% did what I did. 60% did what I did of the women he interviewed. That's all you could say.
Do you think he paid too much of a price for opening up this conversation in the first place, for getting people talking about sex?
Do you know what's interesting is the first thing he did, he was teaching zoology, as you know. And,
yeah, he was studying wasps, wasn't he?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. What bothered him is that the married students didn't seem to know very much about, even the basics, about female biology or male biology. And so he started a course only for married students and for engaged students. If you were a single girl, you could not enter the course because he was so concerned. They wouldn't have let him do the course. And he was absolutely shocked when he asked questions in class and found how naive and ignorant these young people were. He wanted to enlighten them so that they could enjoy this particular human relationship.
Do you think he changed anything, Alice?
Oh, he changed a lot. Oh, God, did he. But he was vilified. It was horrible. And then he himself sort of got caught up into the whole thing.
What do you mean?
He was too much with sex. Day and night he was interviewing. He traveled. He was interviewing more and more people all over, in prison, everywhere. So he was very much caught up in it.
You think he was obsessed with it?
One could say that I wouldn't use the term, but that was his life. That became his life.
Alice, you went on to your own career as a psychoanalyst, as a therapist, as someone who thinks about these issues a lot, right?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And I'm very grateful to him because he made it so comfortable for me to listen to my patients when they talk about their sex life. Because he made me feel comfortable about myself. So I'm very grateful to Kinsey.
I was just wondering if you think back to that interview time that you had with him back when you were a 19-year-old student at Indiana University and think, you know, it was a pretty influential moment in your life.
Absolutely. You are absolutely right. It was very influential. You have to remember, 44... somebody talking so comfortably, making you feel so comfortable about something everybody was so careful not to talk about.
You know, what's interesting to me, Alice, is a couple of times you've made the point that the same divisions within society that vilified Kinsey back in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, those same divisions exist today. You say that people in this country don't want to talk about sex, or they don't want other people talking about sex. Fair enough?
Well, I think if you consider sexual behavior outside a marriage and for procreation sinful, that answers your question, doesn't it?
Well, and homosexuality?
Oh,
by definition, the same?
Absolutely. So those people who feel that way certainly are not are not friends of Kinsey.
So do we need another one? Do we need another Alfred Kinsey to try and move the markers again?
No, we don't really, because the 60s did it.
Got people talking.
Well, not only talking, doing.
Freelance.
Showing, doing. Yeah. Our movies, our television programs. Nothing is spared anymore.
You say that nothing is spared anymore, and I catch in that just a kind of a hint of regret in your voice that maybe some of this stuff should not be publicly discussed. Am I missing something?
It's not discussed. It's shown on television. There are some things I would rather not have. I don't have to look at it. I can change the channel. But it takes some of the mystery out of it, I think.
Some of the passion.
Maybe even the passion, but the mystery. I sort of romanticize about sex, even at my age.
I think that's a good thing.
I think so. I'm pleased about it.
Alice, thanks so much for being with me on the program.
You're more than welcome.
Alice Jeanette Cohn lives in New York. She's 83. She received the Eleanor Roosevelt Humanities Award for her own work as a clinical psychologist. Now, I wonder if you also recall the effect of the release of the Kinsey Report, how they might have changed your own perspective of sex. If you have thoughts or a story about that, you can get in touch with me. Just send me a note at our website, thestory.org. If you go to our website, you'll also see photographs of Alice then, at the time when she met Alfred Kinsey, and now. And we have links to the Kinsey Institute. That's all at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Yesterday on the program, I talked with a number of aging prisoners, men who are quickly becoming a significant feature of the penal system today. Bottom line is that as they get older, and as more of them get older, they're becoming a new cost for taxpayers. Joe Hunt murdered a woman. I asked him about growing old in prison and his own thoughts about possibly getting out.
If the parole board would even turn me down on my past record, I wouldn't feel bad about it.
Why is that?
Because of the crimes and the chances that I had been given before. See, and I messed it up, and here I am. But I still think that a person that's old and no threat, he ain't no good for nothing, they should have a place for him.
Toby from LaGrange, Illinois, wrote to complain about the program, saying that the profiles we chose to give voices to leave their victims silent. Toby wrote, "I cannot imagine driving in a car and hearing the sound of the killer of my child or wife discussing how he should be let out of prison because he has served enough time and is no longer a threat. Life in prison is punishment, and they should die in prison." Toby wrote, "It made me sad to think that we question the idea of keeping murderers behind bars for life because they're too old." Charles from Tallahassee, Florida, wrote to say that he volunteers at the federal women's prison there. "The story I see," says Charles, is that there are so many inmates here, costing us $32,000 per person per year, who would be harmless to others outside. In a way, says Charles, we're punishing ourselves for imprisoning them at such a cost to society. Thanks to the two of you and others who wrote about yesterday's program, we are always open to feedback on the stories that we do, and even more eager to hear your own stories. You can get in touch with me a number of different ways. You can leave me a message on our toll-free line at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. Or you can get in touch with me at The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, 27517. Or leave me a message on our website at thestory.org. Now, in just a moment, another story, a story of discovery. What it's like to meet someone you've never met and someone you never will meet. Mystery. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. If you're in one of those families that gathered people together over the holidays, then you probably found yourself in one of those conversations about family history. Who's the woman in that photo? Where did our grandparents meet anyway? Seems to me that too often those questions go unanswered. And with the passing of each generation, it gets harder and harder to fill in the blanks. Well, this has been much on Freddie Kiger's mind for some time now. The funny thing is, it's not Freddie's family. It's a woman he never met. A woman called Ethel. I'll let Freddie tell you about the trunk he discovered.
I had noticed the trunk in my friend's gathering room, but she used it as nothing more than to put a plate glass over and use it as a coffee table.
So was it one of those old leather trunks
exactly.
with the wooden strapping?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
And then when I moved in, I moved it over into the corner of a room that at the time I was not using, and left it sitting there for probably 2, 3, 4, 5 years before I ever had the overwhelming curiosity to finally open and see what
you
was
weren't,
inside.
You weren't curious enough. Well, let me back up a little bit. You didn't think maybe it was your, you didn't think it belonged to the woman who had the apartment before you.
I knew from asking
yeah.
whose trunk did this belong to,
yeah.
and my friend did not know. As I found out now, it sat downstairs before the house was reconstructed to form 3 apartments. It had been moved upstairs since an upstairs apartment had been moved and sat there in my friend's apartment. And then, of course, I move in, and I was curious, but I never acted upon it.
So what was it that one day prompted you to say, I got to see what's inside that trunk?
A rainy night, middle of the summer. Tremendous thunderstorm. I wasn't ready for bed. And seated on the floor, listening to a David Crosby album, If I Could Only Remember My Name.
It's pretty haunting stuff, that music.
Without question, and that's exactly the weather, what I was feeling, the album, the music, and I went, you know, I'm going to look. And I went over, and I did have this tremendous sense, Dick, of feeling as though I was about to violate someone's world. But I opened, and my eyes first fell upon the Life magazine mid-century issue, about this time, January 1950, with a suffragette staring back at me. And then, like a geologist, I started peeling away the layers.
What were you thinking, Freddie, that it, I mean, at that point, it could have been just someone's collection of old magazines.
Exactly.
Right?
But it was very clear, Dick, very early on when I started finding the endless stream of photographs so meticulously ordered and cared for and layered literally as if I were turning the clock back in this person's life.
So you lift out the magazine, you're looking at the photographs. What was the moment when you realized that what was in the trunk was, in a way, one person's collection or one person's, you know, time capsule?
The photographs gave me no visual record, if you will, of going from point A to point B to deducing. Yeah. But when I found the diary in the red leather that chronicled the life of Miss Ethel Clark Holbrook, that's when it clicked that all this was a photographic record of this woman's life.
Does any of it fit together at that time? Are you, I mean, you look at a photograph of someone as a young woman and then a kid and stuff like that, and you're going, is this the same person? What am I looking at? How easy was it for you to kind of uncover what you were looking at that evening?
Chronologically, it was very easy because it was all stacked in reverse, literally from the latter stages of her life. And then as I got to the bottom of the trunk, literally a picture of her family in Van Wert, Ohio, with she as a four-year-old girl seated on the front porch of a home there, in a Victorian home.
Were there other pieces of paper that told you more about who she was or what she'd done?
There was one pamphlet in particular that was a clear moment for me. It listed her on the front of a pamphlet, hair tightly in bun, 1900-looking photograph. It would appear that the photograph, Dick, would belong in a locket. And underneath her photograph on this pamphlet said simply, pianist.
Huh.
And I opened and found her name, Ethel Clark at the time, and then started understanding that she was quite a talented player who had performed on two continents. Reading the reviews of this instance where she was performing back in Ohio as an accompanying a singer. And then I started to piece together, once I found a couple of scrapbooks of all the plays that she attended. Here was a young woman in a Victorian period of time who was quite talented, quite well-traveled, quite well-read, and who basically loved and practiced the arts.
And she must have come then from a fairly wealthy family because, you know, back in the early 1900s, to be a pianist, not just to play the piano, but to travel and to do that, I guess, what, as a single woman?
That, but I think sometimes, most of the time she was traveling with other members of her family, which would add to your point that I think you're trying to make, is that evidently the Clarks were well-to-do. I can't tell you what her father did. I've seen pictures. I've seen pictures of her grandfather. So now we're reaching back to the mid-19th century. But I can't figure out, I haven't been able to pull the pieces together to understand what they did.
All right, so bring me back to that evening's excavation. When you were going back through her life, as she got younger and younger, as you
right.
got down to the bottom of the trunk, were you able to figure out, Freddie, if she'd packed her life this way, or if maybe a daughter or a niece or someone had done it? Was there any clue there?
That's a great question, and I've thought about it many times. Everything that she did as a young person was so precise. The meticulous cutting out of the handbills, the meticulous way they were glued to these ornate scrapbooks. I can't help but think that probably alone late in her life, husband gone, children away, this was her attempt to give her life some order. A library, if you will, to Ethel Clark Holbrook, that if someone opened, they would be able to learn something about her.
Yeah, but you know, Freddie, more than an index, it also has that feeling of kind of a call for meaning, to give her life some meaning. Do you know what I mean?
No question. I'm alone. I've never been married. And I think that was the profound feeling that hit me that evening after 4.5 hours of going through this woman's life. I looked at my own mortality. if I leave this earth in my present state, unmarried, no children, what record is there of the journey?
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Freddie Kiger found this trunk in his apartment, left it for a couple of years, but then one night decided to open it. He told me that it started from simple curiosity, but then his instincts as a historian took over.
I was, if you will, an historical Sherlock Holmes, trying to pull and piece everything together. So tremendous curiosity at first, and then the more letters I read and the more diary entries that I looked over, and the more times I saw photographs of this woman that I could clearly begin to see morphing and evolving in reverse, if you will, I came to relate with her. At one point, Dick, I literally had all the mementos in my lap. I had just read a quote from Shakespeare about remembering one's experience, and I was so overwhelmed. I mean, I cried. She was my Eleanor Rigby. And in my own twisted way, I sensed, would this be my experience 100 years down the road when someone opens the trunk, perhaps, not only to me, but for all those people in any place and part of the world who live alone?
Hers was not, I don't get the impression from you, an unhappy life.
No. Dick, I felt this wonderful sense and surge of energy and passion and love of life. So my tears were not so much for the loss of this woman. Yeah. She richly lived. Yeah. It was just, I think, I wish someone in her family knew. I wish I was able to hear the phone ring or get a letter. That's my grandmother. That's my mother. That's my great-grandmother. Here was this life richly lived, this jewel of an existence, and no one to pass it on to.
Was there ever a point going through Ethel's diaries, letters, when you kind of felt that you should stop, that it became too personal? Yeah.
Yes, particularly in one letter. After evidently she had returned back to the United States after her training had ended in Paris. So we're talking somewhere around 1904, 1905.
Training, she was trained
to be a pianist.
Right, and to speak French probably.
Exactly, yeah. Of course. I found a letter addressed to her from someone in Paris. And after the first couple of paragraphs, I really was concerned that I had stumbled upon a letter written in French, a love letter, or a letter from someone who was quite an admirer. I took the letter at the time while I was still teaching at Chapel Hill High School to one of the French instructors who translated it for me. And I later on was able to reassure myself that this was just an acquaintance. Mm-hmm. But after two paragraphs, I wasn't certain if I had discovered something that she had tucked away and no one's eyes save hers should have been reading. And yet that was a powerful aphrodisiac, if you will, to continue reading. It's human nature.
Yeah, yeah. Although there is that line, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Am I still looking at what she wants me to look at?
Yeah, exactly.
Or, no, have I?
I don't think that Ethel Clark Holbrook would have allowed that to be a part. She was too proper, too careful a woman, I think, to allow herself to be, if you will, exposed to that light.
You did go a little bit further, right? You searched out this woman's death certificate, or?
Well, in my research, Dick, finally went to Hillsborough, North Carolina, so curious, trying to put some sort of parenthetical marks, if you will, around this person, this woman. And I found her death certificate in Hillsborough, North Carolina, the Office of Records there. She was born April the 26th, 1886. She died March the 7th, 1981. And they listed her simply widow.
Housewife. She lived a long, long life.
Yes, she did.
Well,
and
nights.
From what I could gather, many, many years, perhaps two decades, when her husband probably had passed before.
What led you, though, to search out more about her, to try and find a death certificate?
My own curiosity. To this day, I have no idea, Dick, what her husband did. Who was this wonderful gentleman that I've seen these wonderfully dapper images of.
Right.
What did he do? When did he pass? And why did she choose to stay here in Chapel Hill after he passed, as opposed to returning to Van Wert, Ohio?
You're pretty certain that she had children, right?
At least two.
Uh-huh.
Photographs. And again, I can't document, but, you know, there was one photograph, Dick, that I opened. It was dated April of 1916. And when I opened, these Shirley Temple curls, this creamy white complexion, and the face, not of Ethel Clark Holbrook, but I had to reason, this is perhaps her firstborn.
Mm-hmm.
We have a card that I found to our dearest mother, handmade. And signed,
hand-drawn card.
Yes, yeah. Hand-drawn in watercolor, signed from the two daughters, Mary Ellen and Barbara. I can't tell which daughter I'm looking at because I can clearly see that this is a part of the lineage, if you will, but I don't know names.
You must be hoping that someone will be listening to our conversation and go, Ethel Holbrook, you know, I know someone who knows someone, and we'll get in touch with you.
That is exactly what I hope would happen. This woman's life deserves to be with descendants so that they may be able to treasure the unbelievably full life that this woman lived.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. As Freddie Kiger found himself picking through the carefully stored milestones of Ethel Clark Holbrook's life, he started thinking a lot about his own.
I'm not sure I want to be a male version of Eleanor Rigby. And I don't think any of us, regardless of the connection of whether we're married, whether we have children, there are people out there, and that's the wonderful thing about life, who care and love. We all in the experience have something to pass on. I hope. Isn't that the measure of what it is to be here? Isn't that the measure that you're supposed to make your own life and your world and the people around you a little better because of your existence? I would hope that would be.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with that. I think, you know, to lose that is to lose a whole lot of what makes us human, right?
I think you're right.
Yeah.
There was one photograph of Ethel Clark at the time. I could reason perhaps she was 13 or 14 years of age. And when I was digging through the layers of all this personal journey, I found the photograph of her with long, curly hair down to her shoulders. And the camera was up close to her face.
She's looking into the camera?
Looking directly into the camera with this hair and this eyes and this lighting that to this day is perhaps one of the most haunting photographs I have ever seen in my life. And I took the photograph and felt guilty as if I was stealing from Ethel Clark. But I had it framed, and it hangs on my wall to this day.
You could have just flipped through this as a kind of exercise in you know, the jigsaw puzzle. When was she born? What did she do? Where did she go? Something about her, and I don't know if you can put your finger on it, but something about her actually reached out of the writing, reached out of the photographs, and touched you personally. And I don't know if you've been able to look back on it and figure out why it is you had this emotional connection or this almost personal connection to a woman just through her mementos.
As an historian and with a fantastically close family, the Kigers in northwestern Forsyth County, that embraces great-grandfathers and grandfathers and current generations and cousins and what have you, I had an immediate appreciation for the fact that here was someone whose existence was trapped in a trunk and no one had claimed it, that no one was curious to come back and say, my grandmother or my great-grandmother left something here, and we'd love to have an opportunity.
So that summer evening, you actually had a feeling of letting her out.
There's no question.
Eleanor Rigby picks up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for?
Lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong?
Freddie Kiger has written a magazine article about Ethel Clark Holbrook's trunk, and we have some of the photos from that trunk on our website at thestory.org. And if you can help Freddie track Ethel's family, just send me a short note to that website at thestory.org, and I'll pass it along to Freddie.
All the lonely people, where do they all come from?
The Story is produced by Corey Princell, Denise Schreiner, and Anita Woodley. Jeanette Arrowwood is our researcher. Chris Carmichael is our intern. Our audio editors are Rachel McCarthy, Nick Vidinsky, and Ryan White. Al Wodarski and Peter Bombar are our engineers. The Story's managing editor and director is Carol Jackson. The senior producer of The Story is Greg Kelly. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.